on so many social media platforms, they allow pornography or look the other way when it's uploaded. And then a child could be going through their day-to-day life and be exposed to it.
At a brain level, it's probably a more powerful drug than cocaine or heroin.
The problem of pornography. Catholic bishops are asking for Congress to help protect our children. Plus, how to curb such a powerful addiction. We get expert advice.
The Roberts Court these days is more eager to overturn older precedents than any court we've had at least probably in the last century.
Sweeping decisions this term from the Supreme Court, from affirmative action to the First Amendment and free speech, to working on the Sabbath. In-depth analysis of some of the justices' most significant rulings.
You are better than your circumstance. You are stronger than you know. You can achieve great things.
And in support of mothers and children, a look at some organizations bringing energy, help, and encouragement to young families in need. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
If a man has been training himself that she exists for my pleasure, okay. Well, you can imagine all of the consequences in any relationship that's going to have.
The problem of pornography, from damaging relationships between couples to violating the innocence of children. Catholic bishops ask lawmakers on Capitol Hill to proactively address online exploitation. Recent investigations by the Wall Street Journal and university researchers point to the pervasiveness of pornography on social media sites like Instagram. Algorithms within the site promoting and connecting a vast network of pedophiles to underage sex content. In this dangerous atmosphere, Catholic bishops are asking lawmakers to do something to protect children and crack down on pornography. Reporter Mark Irons begins our coverage.
It may come as no surprise. Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, popular social media platforms, receive billions of online visits each month. But billions of visits are also made each month to pornography websites. Sexually explicit videos or images online are widely accessible, widely viewed, and it's no secret.
I don't mind talking about it. I mean, it's something everyone does.
What are your thoughts on the issue or the matter of pornography?
I don't really think pornography is an issue.
I mean, I agree with her. Just like anything, though, anything in moderation.
The latest data gathered by SimilarWeb, an organization that analyzes global internet traffic, shows pornography sites are among the most popular websites in the world. But you don't have to go to porn sites to be exposed to sexually explicit material. It's all around you, including on those top social media sites, Twitter and Instagram.
Both are actually rated as one of the top places that teens are exposed to pornography.
Haley McNamara is the vice president of strategy and communication with the National Center on Sexual Exploitation. Its message, pornography is not only widespread, it's a major problem.
We do view pornography as a form of sexual exploitation and don't believe that there's really any ethical form of pornography.
McNamara describes the three-part concern. First, noting pornography is bad for those who make it.
It causes psychological and often physical trauma to performers.
It's bad for the viewer.
Including impaired motivation and impulse control. And also that there's severe impacts on mental health as well. Pornography use is linked with more depressive symptoms, more anxiety, also less relationship satisfaction.
And McNamara says it's bad for society.
Pornography is connected with sex trafficking, child sexual abuse, sexual violence against women.
Exposure to pornography can be especially harmful to children. In early June, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops encouraged lawmakers to address the growing problem of online exploitation. A letter to Congress signed by four Catholic bishops expresses the need to shield children from pornographic material, saying, quote, "Seeing it steals their innocence and gives them a distorted image of sexuality, relationships, and men and women, which may then affect their behavior, including addiction to pornography." There has been some acknowledgement from states and corporations of the problem. More than a dozen states have declared pornography a public health crisis. And a number of states, including Virginia and Utah, have passed laws requiring pornographic websites to screen access through age verification. McNamara told us Apple has now committed to using a nudity blurring tool, which would be turned on by default for users age 12 and under. There seems to be consensus for children or for those who are addicted, pornography is a problem. But there also seems to be an idea that if adults are involved in the production or viewing of pornography, and it's something you occasionally look at, there's no harm.
As long as everyone in the film is consenting adults and they understand what's going on, that's fine.
I don't have any problem with it in general.
I wouldn't see the problem in it. It's in the privacy of your own home. So,
got it.
Go for it.
According to different studies, most men have viewed pornography. This 2021 survey from Ledger and The Atlantic found 68% of American men said they have watched it.
There's enough struggle with it that it absolutely warrants it being brought to the surface and paid attention to.
Father Chris Christensen, a Catholic priest in Northern Virginia, says pornography distorts a proper understanding not only of sex, but of healthy human relationships.
If that's the way we're feeding ourselves with regards to what human relationship is supposed to be, well, no wonder we got a lot of problems relationally in today's world. No wonder we can't get along. No wonder people have issues and questions about identity and sexuality. My approach, my view, my understanding of the world, the way that I see others, all that is affected by pornography.
Pope Francis has spoken out against pornography, and in a pastoral document, U.S. Catholic bishops write, "The damage it causes to oneself, one's relationships, society, and the body of Christ needs healing. Pornography can never be justified and is always wrong." Acknowledging that may be the first step.
Do you think pornography is a problem?
I feel like it is.
Meet Caleb and Rebecca, a couple who talked about pornography differently from what we had been hearing on the streets. Caleb even had the courage to admit it's something he has struggled with.
I think it can just be damaging to like how we relate to one another, like in real life, by kind of having these fake relationships online and building this connection to something that's not real.
When he first told Rebecca about his own struggle with pornography, she had initial concerns, but she says Caleb's struggle doesn't define him. Rebecca has been encouraging, and their relationship has grown in trust.
The fact that he felt comfortable enough, like, to tell me what was going on, like, it definitely did make me feel closer to him, and, like, he was trusting me and, like, knowing that about him.
It's in the struggle against the sin that virtue is formed.
Father Christensen says healing and forgiveness can be found in the sacrament of confession, and conquering sins, including pornographic use in any degree, is always possible in Christ.
Never, ever give up hope. So every day is a new day. You begin again every day. Every time you go to confession, in Christ we have victory. So victory is possible. Hope is absolutely essential.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in depth.
As we saw in Mark's report, pornography impacts those who make it as well as those who watch it. We spoke with psychologist Bob Schutz, a therapist for more than 30 years and the founder of the John Paul II Healing Center, about the psychological impacts of porn.
Pornography has many psychological impacts. One of them, and maybe the most personally pervasive one for the individual, is it brings a sense of shame, which then becomes a barrier to giving and receiving love. It also creates an imagery that portrays men and women, depending on what the pornography is, in a stereotypical way, and then creates an objectification of the person who then becomes an object of pleasure rather than a person to be loved.
Therapy is essential in learning how to overcome addiction, but modern technology is also being used to help people break free. Rhonda Haas, the founder of Covenant Eyes, which provides support, resources, and innovative accountability, works to guide people to live without porn. He joins us now to tell us more. Thank you so much for joining us for this very important conversation. We just heard from Dr. Bob Schutz on some of the mental health impacts of this kind of addiction. What trauma is described to you or the people who are in recovery?
I have honestly received literally hundreds of letters this year regarding pornography and the devastation that it has done to young people. These letters come from young people who over and over again say they were addicted to pornography at 12 years old, seems to be kind of the average age. It ranges as young as 9 years old all the way up to 14. And over and over again, they say, I was addicted to pornography at that young age, despite the fact that I was raised in a Christian home and I still go to church and all that. But nevertheless, it has devastated these young people's lives.
Now, you have this program, Covenant Eyes, and resource that has help for men, women, spouses, and families. But a main theme on your website is that you're not alone in the struggle against this addiction. When we chatted with Dr. Schutz, he mentioned the importance of community. Take a listen.
The most important thing is not to think you can do it by yourself. It almost always the healing comes when it gets brought out into the light and not just shared arbitrarily, but shared with people who are compassionate and merciful and have some kind of an understanding of how to help somebody work through that.
Can you talk about the accountability app and the mercy you see from the community that comes together through Covenant Eyes?
And not just the accountability app. Covenant Eyes is a tool that is used to enhance accountability. But accountability really occurs between people. The verse that I always refer to regarding accountability is 1 Corinthians 13. It says, brethren, even if anyone is caught in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness. Each one looking to yourself so that you too will not be tempted, bear one another's burdens and thereby fulfill the law of Christ. And I believe that that essence of the one another verses in the Bible and even the second greatest commandment to love your neighbor as yourself that Jesus talks about implied in that is that we care for one another and bear one another's burdens. And so the accountability app that Covenant Eyes provides is simply a tool that enables us to do that by providing an over-the-shoulder look at your use of your computer. Mm. And that over-the-shoulder, the person over-the-shoulder, is your ally, a trusted friend, or perhaps a spouse or a pastor, a priest, a counselor, or whoever is close to you and cares about you.
Someone that's on your side rather than someone who's condemning you. Now, I'd love to learn a little bit more about how you're trying to find people online. I know that even doing research for this story, immediately I got a million ads for Covenant Eyes. They're showing up everywhere. Tell me more.
Covenant Eyes has been providing accountability since the year 2000. We've been doing it for over 23 years now. And the idea is exactly that. It is not meant to be a means of policing or a means of punishment. It's not meant to be something that is forced on you. Not at all. In fact, our user agreement specifies that everyone who uses the program, when you sign up for Covenant Eyes, you have to agree that you're doing this voluntarily. Mm-hmm. And it's a voluntary offering to an ally, a trusted ally of yours that will allow them to view. And what they see is a daily report that has blurred images, slightly blurred. They're blurred enough that you can't read text, for instance. But you can still make out basically what the image is, more or less. Sometimes it's a little difficult, but nevertheless, when you look at the complete record, when a person, when the ally can see a record of my accountability use, then overall, they get an overall picture. Am I doing anything that is really troubling? And, you know, when you look at the way that the internet is designed, much of the internet is designed to lure you in. And it does exactly that. That's why these 12-year-olds get lured in. They click on an image or they type in a keyword. For instance, one of the letters said, I typed in American girl.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. And all of a sudden they're lured in and they become entrapped. It becomes overwhelming for them, especially at that young age. And that's the sex training that much of our youth is getting right now.
That's very scary. Well, we're so grateful for what you're doing and your witness and for engaging in innovative ways to help people recover. Thank you.
Yeah, you're certainly welcome.
There are many resources to understand this addiction, find community to help overcome it, and technology to block certain sites and podcasts to learn more about its impacts. Several of these resources are listed on your screen, including Covenant Eyes, Canopy, and Restore the Glory. There's a lot more ahead on this edition of EWTN News In Depth. Major decisions from this term of the U.S. Supreme Court. Analysis next. And why all the controversy about the Archbishop appointed to lead the Vatican's most significant office. Our news team explains. And we talk to volunteers helping young mothers provide a healthy start for their newborn children. We'll be back in a moment.
I strongly disagree with the court's decision here. So today, I want to assure our students, our borrowers, and families across America, our fight is not over. We're taking action.
A defiant tone from the White House reacting to policy setbacks for this administration from the U.S. Supreme Court as the High Court ends its 2023 term. Welcome back to EWTN News In Depth as we take a broad look at major developments from this year's court term. The final week included several big court decisions upending some key Biden administration priorities, including student loan forgiveness and affirmative action in college admissions. In a 6-3 vote, the conservative majority struck down President Joe Biden's student debt relief program, ruling it was an unlawful exercise of presidential power because it had not been explicitly approved by Congress. As we had just heard from Education Secretary Miguel Cardona, the administration immediately announced it's now working on alternate plans under different legal frameworks within the Education Department to provide some form of debt relief. And in another ruling, the White House criticized the same conservative justices, again by a vote of 6-3, ended affirmative action at colleges and universities across the country by invalidating admissions programs at Harvard and the University of North Carolina. Chief Justice John Roberts, writing for the majority, said universities now must use colorblind criteria in selecting their student bodies. The court did not entirely close the door on racial considerations. Roberts wrote, applicants may still discuss in their applications how race has affected their lives, something civil rights attorneys immediately commented on after the decision.
We call upon the universities themselves to continue to engage in substantial outreach in recruitment of underserved students in underserved communities all across the country. They can do that previously, and they should continue to do that. Nothing in this opinion prohibits that.
In another high-profile case, what legal analysts call a loss for conservatives in a major ruling about elections, the High Court rejected the independent state legislature theory advanced by the Republican-nominated North Carolina state legislature. It would have given state lawmakers the power to set election rules with little oversight from state courts. Opponents say the theory would have led to unchecked partisan gerrymandering and laws making it harder for people to vote, potentially upending the 2024 congressional and presidential elections. Again, the vote was 6-3 with a new configuration this time, with Justices Sotomayor, Kagan, and Ketanji Brown Jackson joining Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett. And big decisions came in two major cases involving free speech and religious liberty. In 303 Creative versus Elenis, the court's conservatives voted 6-3 in favor of a Christian graphic artist who does not want to create wedding websites for same-sex couples. Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote artist Lori Smith's First Amendment right to free speech cannot compel her to create a message she does not believe in. And in Groff versus DeJoy, in a unanimous ruling, the high court strengthened the rights of religious in the workplace. The justices sided in part with a Sabbath observant mail carrier who quit his job with the U.S. Postal Service to avoid delivering packages on Sundays. The ruling said employers must meet a higher standard to prove religious accommodations cause an undue burden to their business. Constitutional scholar and appellate attorney Adam White joins us now to talk about 303 Creative and the Postal Service case. He's senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and served on the Presidential Commission on the Supreme Court. Welcome back, Adam. It's great to see you. You're our regular analyst here. The Supreme Court term wrapped up with much commotion, but it seems free speech and religious liberty fared well. Let's discuss free speech first. The 303 Creative case. Lori Smith, the website designer who won her case out of Colorado, had this to say about her win. Let's take a listen.
My case is about speech, and when speech is concerned, speech should be protected. Today's victory protects not just me, but protects the LGBT website designer. Everyone should be free to create consistent with what he or she believes. And whether your views on marriage are similar to mine or perhaps different, nobody should be forced to create a message that goes against his or her convictions.
Now, Adam, do you think she was answering her critics who say this decision is discriminatory?
The Supreme Court did hold here that the First Amendment interests in free speech supersede Colorado's application of a non-discrimination law. But in this case, the justices in the majority made it clear, as important as anti-discrimination laws have historically been in many contexts, here the free speech interests in the First Amendment are preeminent. And so they weren't denigrating anti-discrimination laws across the board, not for businesses or for others. They were just saying that when your service that you're selling to the public involves creative speech, the First Amendment prevails.
Now, there are other criticisms as well. Professor Lawrence Tribe from Harvard Law School said the entire 303 Creative case was hypothetical. Here's his claim.
Lori Smith is putting a purely hypothetical case before the court. She didn't really have a business for customized web designs. She just asked hypothetically, if I were to design wedding sites on my website, would I have to do it for gay couples as well as straight couples? And the court, instead of doing what a normal court would do and say, that's a hypothetical question, we're not here to give advisory opinions. Instead of that, because this was a setup case that they were welcoming, they swung at it. And as far as I'm concerned, they hit a foul ball.
So what is he referring to about the facts of the case?
In this case, I think it's Professor Tribe who's swinging and missing. In First Amendment jurisprudence around the free speech, the free speech clause of the First Amendment, the Supreme Court has long protected the public from the chilling effects of restrictions on speech. Professor Tribe has written about this at length himself in the past. Here, Ms. Smith had the company 303 Creative. It was a creative design company. She wanted to expand it. She's very credible in her explanation of why and when and how she would expand it into creating wedding websites. And in this case, that's more than enough to justify her standing to sue against the Colorado regulations. I really think here it's Professor Tribe and other critics of Ms. Smith's speech. They're the ones, I think, who are creating arguments that don't really exist.
Now, Adam, you've been tracking how the Supreme Court has changed protections for people of faith. Some say that this win is part of the Supreme Court's chipping away at protections for the LGBTQ community that were granted by first the same-sex marriage decision in 2015 and then the transgender rights decision in 2020. Is this true?
No, not at all. And it's important to keep in mind that Justice Gorsuch, who wrote the opinion for the court in 303 Creative, respecting free speech, is the same justice who wrote the majority opinion just a year or two ago in Bostock, the case involving the Civil Rights Act, sexual orientation, and gender identity. In the same way that Justice Kennedy before him, the justice who did more than any other justice to expand the court's recognition of same-sex marriage rights, was the justice who wrote the court's majority opinion in Masterpiece Cake Shop. Most justices, even the ones who have stood up for LGBT rights, they're able to recognize that free speech and religious liberty are also constitutionally protected values, and they're able to strike the right balance between them. This is not a case about rolling back any rights. It's simply a case where the court refused to further expand anti-discrimination laws to trump the First Amendment.
That's powerful. Well, let's discuss the big 9-0 win this term on employee religious freedom protections. DeJoy versus Groff, where a Christian postal worker won the right to rest on the Sabbath. How does this victory affect others?
At the time of year when we mostly focus on 5-4 and 6-3 decisions, it is good to see the court unanimous here. It's an important decision. The court was clearing up some bad case law that really did limit the scope of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act to protect religious liberty. The court unanimously reaffirmed that a company can't ignore somebody's religious practices unless the company itself really would face substantial hardship in its own business. The court clarified that in this case. It's an important decision. It's not it's not a radical change in law, but cleaning up some bad precedent from the lower courts.
Well, we've seen that the Title VII discussion around accommodations for LGBTQ individuals also have made some Christians very worried. Does this Title VII clarification for religious accommodations do anything for the Christian employer or any of the other cases, the 303 Creative case?
Well, I'd say the Groff versus DeJoy case certainly does help to respect the rights under the Civil Rights Act of all religious believers, and including those who are facing hardship on other grounds. I'd say it's a pretty limited but important decision there. 303 Creative is also an important case respecting free speech, but again, it's not charting a broad new path. Rather, it's just protecting free speech rights that already exist.
With the Dobbs victory last year overturning Roe versus Wade and these decisions now, many are throwing their hands up in the air and calling for reforms to the Supreme Court once again. Representative Adam Schiff of California suggested packing the court. Are any of these suggestions you addressed before on the Supreme Court Commission up for real consideration?
No, not seriously. I've seen the court's critics once again calling for President Biden to pack the court. And President Biden, to his credit, has once again resisted those calls. We're going to continue to see these attacks on the court, calls to restructure the court. But it's impossible for me to see a path forward on that kind of structural reform now, thank goodness.
And what about the issues of ethics concerns? We're wrapping up the Supreme Court term. Everyone's taking a look at some of the claims of impropriety over disclaimers of the use of financial gain from donors, et cetera. What can you say about that?
Well, judicial ethics are incredibly important. Justices and judges in our country have immense power in their institution. And so we all should care about judicial ethics, including the justices themselves. I think it's important for them to take these criticisms seriously and respond to them honestly. But at the same time, we can't allow judicial ethics laws to become a heckler's veto on the court's legitimacy. A number of people who are raising these concerns against the justices really are wielding them, not in good faith, but as weapons. And we're seeing serious questions raised about the quality of journalism surrounding these attacks on the justices.
Well, that's definitely something that we're looking at. What else can we look at from the Supreme Court? Anything else that's on the horizon that we might see next term?
Well, the court's already announced that it will hear a couple of important cases in my usual field of focus, the administrative state, cases involving the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and the powers of independent officers within agencies like the SEC. So those are very important cases. I'd say for this term that just concluded, we saw the resolution of the affirmative action cases. The year before that was Dobbs. Affirmative action and abortion were, of course, two of the central issues during the rise of the conservative legal movement. Now that those issues are resolved, at least for now, it'll be interesting to see what new issues appear on the court's radar.
Well, we'll be looking for that and asking you to come and join us to talk about it. Thank you so much, Adam.
Gladly.
I saw the Gabriel Project really as an opportunity to be a part of the solution in our community of helping moms.
Next, family support from a network of helping hands. We take a look at the impact of groups protecting life by providing compassionate assistance. EWTN News In Depth will be right back.
Of the overturning of Roe versus Wade, many states are passing legislation to support mothers in the first year after their child is born. U.S. federal law requires states to provide pregnancy-related Medicaid coverage through 60 days of postpartum. But the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021 allows states to expand that coverage for up to an entire year. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, as of June 30th, 2023, the states in blue already have the 12-month Medicaid extension implemented. That is 36 states, including Washington, D.C. The states in green are planning to implement a 12-month extension. Two states in yellow have proposed extending Medicaid coverage with some limits on time or who is eligible. And the states in light blue have pending legislation to seek federal approval. That potential Medicaid assistance is just some of the help being directed at young mothers. There are also more localized programs, some volunteer, some county-funded, designed to support women and their children. Reporter Roselle Reyes tells us about two such programs.
It takes a village to raise a child. In Montgomery County, Maryland, a lot of hands are hard at work to support pregnant women and their babies, from medical needs to material items to companionship.
Montgomery County is a safe place. You are welcome here. We want you here. We have programs for you here.
Rebecca Smith is the senior administrator for maternal child health programs at Montgomery County. For decades, she has worked with pregnant mothers to ensure a healthy pregnancy through programs such as Babies Born Healthy.
We target only African-American women for that program because of the huge disparities in birth outcomes. I'll just make it simple. Either the baby is born too small or too early or doesn't live or the mom has maternal complications.
According to the National Vital Statistics System, in 2021, 1,205 women died of maternal causes in the United States. Based on the data, the maternal mortality rate for black women was 2.6 times the rate for white women. The same can be seen in infant mortality rates. Infants of black women had the highest mortality rate on average between 2017 to 2019. Angeline Bell, nurse manager for Babies Born Healthy, says they provide a range of resources for pregnant mothers.
We do home visiting. We do in-person classes, virtual classes. We do a lot of education via social media. But we help them to advocate for themselves. We're there to support them throughout their pregnancy. We want all babies to be born healthy, you know, not just black and brown. We want all babies to be born healthy. But in order to do that, we have to close the gap.
Lynette Byfield was a former client of Babies Born Healthy. For her firstborn child, she ended up having an emergency C-section due to complications. So when she found out she was pregnant with her second child, she wanted to be more prepared and informed. That's when she signed up for Babies Born Healthy.
Talk to your doctor when you are concerned, when you are worried. Speak up. Because a lot of times when we don't know anything, we're not going to say anything.
Lynette welcomed her beautiful son. She now works for the Babies Born Healthy as a community health worker, so she in turn can continue to help African American women like her.
It's very fulfilling to be a part of that and to be able to know, like, hey, I was there, I get it, I can help you.
The Gabriel Project is another organization that helps pregnant women and their children.
We wanted to save lives and to let pregnant mothers know that there are many resources available to them.
Diane Ranke, with her husband Budney, have been coordinating the Gabriel Project in Montgomery County for almost 30 years.
We want them to know that we love them, we love their babies, and that God loves them.
Each expectant mother is also assigned what they call an angel friend.
We're there for her, and we provide friendship, spiritual support, and also material needs like clothing and diapers and formula, cribs, strollers, whatever she needs.
Every angel friend like Jill accompanies an expectant mother during and after her pregnancy. Another angel friend, Susan Grieving, remembers one of her former clients, who was at the time 5 months pregnant and living in a shelter.
She really just tugged at my heart because, you know, life had really kind of beaten her down.
With the help of the Gabriel Project, the mother-to-be persevered despite her circumstances. Grieving says by walking with these women during a time of need, they form a special and meaningful bond.
I love seeing the photographs that some of the other angel friends share, the beautiful babies that are born, and just how happy and grateful they are.
Natalie Ray has worked with the Gabriel Project for more than 27 years and serves as board secretary. Her day-to-day responsibilities include taking in, sorting through, and organizing donations that will be distributed to families.
Our mothers feel the weight of the world on them. And as I envision every little bit of help that we're able to give, we're carrying that little piece of their burden, that little piece of their anxiety and worry for them and with them.
Volunteer Don Kenny says he started off just assisting his wife, who was a committed member of the Gabriel Project. However, a special encounter made him a lifelong member, a boy praising the organization.
He said, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for my life. Can you think of a better reason to continue doing this kind of work?
Rosal Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
Although the Gabriel Project in Maryland is not connected to the nationwide network, you can find a Gabriel Project near you by visiting gabrielproject.org for a list of regions that participate throughout the U.S. Top headlines are next in the Week in Review. A push for peace and calls for Ukrainian children to be returned to their homes tops the Week in Review. A Vatican peace envoy returned from Russia late last week following a visit to war-torn Ukraine. Cardinal Matteo Zuppi met with several Russian leaders as well as Russian Orthodox Patriarch Kirill in Moscow last Thursday. Zuppi said he's working on a mechanism that could ensure the return of children who, according to Kyiv, have been abducted and taken to Russia. The cardinal says it's important to find humanitarian initiatives that could open up paths to achieving peace. In his meeting with Kirill, Zuppi pressed for more dialogue.
Now that there is a more heated situation, more dialogue is needed, not less than before. As Christians, we must help each other to understand what to do.
I think that today, in these conditions, which are also marked by many risks and many dangers, the churches can jointly prevent the negative development of political events and serve the cause of peace and justice.
Zuppi also celebrated Mass at the Catholic Cathedral of the Immaculate Conception of the Blessed Virgin Mary in Moscow. Zuppi met with Pope Francis following his visit to Moscow to continue discussions about resolving humanitarian issues. Pope Francis has appointed a new prefect for the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith. Argentinian Bishop Victor Manuel Fernandez will take the role, which is one of the most powerful in the Roman Curia. The Curia can be compared to cabinets in governments, helping the Pope in day-to-day governance. Curia is a Latin term meaning court. It acts in the Pope's name and with his authority to carry out church affairs. The Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith is one of the oldest departments in the Church, established in 1542. It was founded to defend the Catholic Church from heresy. It's the body responsible for promulgating and defending Roman Catholic doctrine. And it has evolved over time within the last century, with several name changes. In 1908, Pope Pius X reorganized it and changed its name to the Sacred Congregation of the Holy Office. In 1965, Pope Paul VI changed it again, calling it the Sacred Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, and updated methods used to examine doctrines. In 1988, Pope John Paul II reformed the entire Roman Curia and gave new competencies to the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. It was during the 80s that then Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger became prefect of this important office.
Lasting legacy of Joseph Ratzinger as this prefect for the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith was how he pushed consistently and for years to guide the church's response to the clergy sexual abuse crisis. It was largely through his influence that the cases were essentially brought under the umbrella of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith.
Following the lead of then Ratzinger in 2022, Pope Francis moved the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors to the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith. It's a reform that maintains the commission as a separate body within the dicastery, but allows for direct access to the Holy Father. And Barrett Doyle, co-director of bishopaccountability.org, a group that tracks sexual abuse in the church, released a statement voicing concerns about the appointment of Archbishop Fernandez. He claims that Fernandez refused to believe the victims of abuse in his home archdiocese of La Plata, Argentina, and disregarded the safety of children. In response, a spokesperson for Fernandez said the archbishop never expressed that he did not believe the victims. Fernandez will take his new position in September. The Fernandez appointment has created an explosion of criticism. Senior editor Jonathan Liddle of the National Catholic Register joins us now from Rome to help explain why it's been so controversial. Jonathan, great to have you with us. You just got to Rome, but you've been following this appointment since last weekend. How was the expected, unexpected appointment received? I say that because the previous prefect's five-year term was over.
It was over. And, you know, Archbishop Fernandez has been, of course, linked to Pope Francis for a long time. He's been a ghostwriter of his on key documents such as Amoris Laetitiae, the post-apostolic exhortation, or post-synodal exhortation from 2015 on the family. But you're right, Monsi, that this was, in a way, kind of shocking and definitely one of Pope Francis's more controversial picks. Archbishop Fernandez, up to this point, had kind of operated in the background of the papacy, serving that key role as a theological advisor and a writer. So to bring him into such a prominent position as the prefect of the Dicaster of the Doctrine of the Faith is certainly a bold move by the Pope. A lot of the concern centers around some of the theological views of Archbishop Fernandez. He has described himself as more progressive than the Pope on many issues. And he also, when then Cardinal Bergoglio, Pope Francis now, wanted to install him as the rector of the Catholic University of Argentina about 11 years ago, it was actually initially blocked by the Vatican at the time out of concerns over Archbishop Fernandez's orthodoxy. So I think, though, as much as this is controversial because of, you know, some of the content of Archbishop Fernandez's theological thought, it's also a controversial appointment in the way it was made. It was made very unconventionally, actually, a personal letter that had been written from by Pope Francis to Archbishop Fernandez was published by the Vatican. And in it, Pope Francis talks about how previously the Dicaster for the Doctrine of the Faith had used immoral methods to achieve its ends and had been more about pursuing doctrinal errors instead of promoting theological knowledge. And the Pope was looking to Archbishop Fernandez for, quote, certainly something different. So there's been a lot of speculation about what exactly Pope Francis meant by that and what exactly will be in store with Archbishop Fernandez as the prefect of the DDF.
Well, some of the context of what might be in store can come from the outrage over a book that Archbishop Fernandez wrote 10 years into his priesthood on kissing. What does this book actually cover? There's a lot of kind of myths going around just because of the name of the book.
You're right. I mean, the name is, it does kind of hit you in the kisser, so to speak. Heal Me With Your Mouth, The Art of Kissing is the name of this book that Archbishop Fernandez wrote as a young priest in his early 30s, published in 1995. And really, in his own words, this was it was a pastoral catechetical tool that he wrote as a way of connecting with young people in his parish at the time and trying to demonstrate to them, trying to show to them that actually, you know, kissing can be an appropriate way of displaying affection in a relationship before and even during marriage, trying to encourage people to remain chaste. So certainly noble intentions, but I think a lot of the criticism and concern about the book has dealt with some of its content. Some poems, which are very sensual and somewhat graphic, and people even describing them as verging on erotica. So a lot of questions about the prudence of publishing this book. Archbishop Fernandez himself has defended his decision to do that. He said he was a young priest trying to connect with people in his parish. And he said that this book, Heal Me With Your Mouth, should not be looked at as an example of his high-level theological work.
Right. Well, however, this book does pale in comparison to some of the claims over his mishandling of sex abuse cases, a case that ended in the suicide of an accused priest. What can you tell us about this? I know he recently apologized for the way that he handled this, and that has been part of some of the different places that he's come out to clarify his positions and also his handling of certain things on Facebook.
That's right. So as Archbishop of La Plata, some allegations against the diocesan priest there resurfaced after 2018, after Archbishop Fernandez became the ordinary of that archdiocese. At the time, the allegations against him are that he didn't sufficiently believe the accusations being made of sexual abuse by a priest. He initially defended himself and said that he believed both the person coming forward with the allegations against the priest, but also needed to respect canonical processes and make sure that the priest was subject to a fair process, even after the priest committed suicide in 2019. But you're right, he has actually just today come out on Twitter, Archbishop Fernandez, saying that he would have handle it differently if you could go back in time to 2018 when those allegations first resurfaced. And you're right, Monsi, this is significant because he, as the prefect of the doctrine or the dicaster of the doctrine of the faith, technically accusations of sexual abuse against clergy are handled by the DDF. Now, Pope Francis has made a slight adjustment where those accusations will be handled by almost a sub office within the dicastery with its own professionals. And something Archbishop Fernandez has said in his acceptance of this post is that one of the only reasons he did accept it is because he would not be the one ultimately, in a sense, or at least kind of in the midst of these different accusations of sexual abuse against clergy. He said that he doesn't have the canonical background to excel at that, and initially turned down the position to head the DDF, partially because these issues of sexual abuse allegations against clergy are part of it. But he was assured by the Pope that it wouldn't be his
mandate. Well, really quick, we just have a couple of seconds. They call this dicastery La Suprema, the most important. There are rumors that Archbishop Fernandez could soon become a cardinal. Are those true? And purely politically, do you think many are worried this could set him up to follow in Pope Benedict's footsteps to become the Pope one day, just as he did under JP2?
Well, I think in terms of Archbishop Fernandez becoming Cardinal Fernandez, I think that that certainly might be likely. Pope Francis is in the last chapter of his papacy. He's not getting any younger. He's definitely had a lot of health issues. There's a lot of talk about him securing his legacy. However, I think it would be definitely premature to think that somehow him having this role will automatically lead to him or likely lead to him being a pope anytime soon. I think he doesn't have the widespread respect that Joseph Ratzinger did before he became Pope Benedict XVI. And I think also, you know, he's appointed to this role as prefect, but a prefect is only in place so long as the pope wants him there. So we'll have to see, you know, after Pope Francis does pass, whoever succeeds him, whether he wants to continue with Archbishop Fernandez as his prefect of the dicastery for the doctrine of the faith. So we'll have to see.
Well, we certainly pray for the Holy Father's health. Thank you so much, Jonathan, for everything that you do, and enjoy the internal city.
Thank you, Monsi.
A psychologist says Theodore McCarrick, the first and only U.S. cardinal to be criminally charged for sexual molestation, is not competent to stand trial. After examination, the expert for the prosecution says the former Archbishop of Washington, D.C., is suffering from dementia and is unable to participate in his criminal trial. The 92-year-old faces three charges in Massachusetts of indecent assault and battery on a person over the age of 14. The accuser told police that McCarrick, who was close to his family, abused him over several years, including at a wedding ceremony in Massachusetts. McCarrick pleaded not guilty to the charges in September of 2021. A judge will make a decision on McCarrick's competency at the end of August. McCarrick was defrocked by Pope Francis in 2019 after a Vatican investigation determined he sexually molested adults as well as children. He also faces criminal sex assault charges in the state of Wisconsin, filed in April. A nod to the importance of the elderly in our lives. Pope Francis has granted a plenary indulgence for those who visit seniors this month in anticipation of the third annual World Day for Grandparents and the Elderly on July 23rd. That's the Sunday before the Feast of Saints Anne and Joachim, the grandparents of Jesus. The pontiff often speaks about the dignity of the elderly and the importance of grandparents in passing on the faith. And some news from EWTN. This week, we launched our International Summer Academy in Rome. The program brings together young journalists and communicators from more than 20 countries to focus on the role of Catholic journalism. Participants are discussing many topics, including the theology of news, the impact of artificial intelligence on communications, and learning about the latest technologies in video journalism. Faculty members come from the Wall Street Journal, Columbia University, the Angelicum, and of course, our EWTN News team. The program establishes an alumni network to provide ongoing support and assistance to these young journalists as they navigate their professional journeys in Catholic media. We have them all in our prayers.
In meeting the need, you are respecting the individual and you're enabling them to live with the dignity that God would wish for all of us in our life.
When we return, the inside story of the Irish charity Trocare.
For 40 years, providing aid during both man-made and natural disasters around the globe.
And finally today, we feature the work of a charity created by the Catholic bishops of Ireland in the early 1970s that has done groundbreaking work around the world to help the oppressed and starving. From the civil wars in Central America to famines in Africa to Asian tsunamis, Trocra has been there providing humanitarian aid. Correspondent Colm Flynn has our report.
In Somalia, in East Africa, people are living in dire poverty, but are now being given access to life-saving medical care. In Zimbabwe, a family whose crops and livelihood were devastated after a drought now have food to eat and a chance at survival. In Honduras, in Central America, the land of these local indigenous people is being taken by large mining companies. But now, they are learning about their rights and reclaiming their homes. And in the West Bank, in Palestine, aid is being brought to those whose lives have been devastated by violent and bloody conflict. These are just some of the over 350 programs that the Irish charity Trocra is engaged in all over the world. It was established in 1973 by the bishops of the Irish Catholic Church, and over the past 50 years, Trocra has provided aid and assistance to millions of people in some of the worst affected regions of the world. Its CEO is Quiva Dabara, and she explains why the charity came into existence.
Trocra was established in response to the poverty and also humanitarian disasters that were at that point being televised and being brought into our living rooms here in Ireland.
With over 40 people dying per day at the moment, and with only a minuscule emergency relief operation.
That's really interesting. That was one of the catalysts, the fact that we were getting kind of these television pictures for the first time, which made people want to help.
That's right. So there was the Biafra war in the late 1960s. There were huge floods in Bangladesh. So people were seeing these almost for the first time in their own living rooms.
With a great deal of shock and sadness among the Irish people as to what they were seeing on their TV screens, the Irish bishops decided to set up a charity where the Irish people could help in a very practical way. Bishop William Crean is the chairman of Trocra.
It was part of a whole sense of movement at that time in the life of the church, where there was a great consciousness of the injustices that prevailed across the world. It wasn't primarily to proclaim the gospel of itself, but it was to live the gospel to wherever the need prevailed. There were no conditions placed on it.
It has been a very difficult 3 days. Very, very difficult.
In 1992, a drought in Somalia caused a devastating famine, where around 300,000 people starved to death. Mary Robinson, the then President of Ireland, went to visit the country and couldn't hold back her tears in front of the world's media.
And I'm sorry that I cannot be entirely calm speaking to you, because I have such a sense of what the world must take responsibility for.
The Irish President and Trocra were responsible for millions of pounds of aid being sent to Somalia at the time, and that work is still being done today, over 30 years later. Paul Healy is Trocra's country director in Somalia, where again, another drought has caused unthinkable suffering.
So in Somalia at the moment, it's probably, well, the worst I've seen in my 25 years in this part of the world, Colm. There are currently about 8 million people who are extremely food insecure. About 1.4 million people have been displaced in the last year due to drought. So it's a very, very bleak situation. And our health facilities are inundated with children who are really on the edge.
To Today, over 400 people work for Trocra, and their annual budget is around 58 million euro, 24 million of which comes from the Irish government.
You see hope. Often it's on the faces of children, despite huge poverty and neglect. And you feel you've really done a good day's work.
And now, with the changing face of Ireland, some Africans living in Ireland are volunteering with the charity, trying to raise awareness of social justice and human rights issues in the world, like Grace Ogunsanya.
Working with Trocra, Grace, do you feel like you're making a difference?
Absolutely, because every little help that you can make, it's not about you erupting the whole world. Yeah. Every little thing counts. It's making a difference in the life of someone, somewhere. If I see an organization helping an African country, why not support them?
This year, Trocra celebrates its 50th anniversary. And with the war in Ukraine, civil unrest in parts of Africa, the recent devastating earthquake in Syria and Turkey, the work of NGOs and charities like Trocra is still very much needed.
What is it about the Catholic faith, the qualities or the values that propel an organization like Trocra forwards?
It's essentially the gospel. As long as you did it to the least of these, you've done it to me, the words of Jesus. It's a gospel imperative.
What keeps the team going at Trocra? Because it must be disheartening sometimes when more problems appear around the world, more suffering with the war in Ukraine, with famines and droughts in Africa still today. What keeps people driven here to continue to help?
What we have the privilege of seeing is the difference we make in people's lives every day. And I think we innately then understand that somebody who is suffering in another country, whether it's because their human rights are being violated, whether it's because they are being beaten up for trying to just participate in a normal democracy, or whether they're suffering from poverty and hunger, that we innately feel an empathy and we feel simply that's not right. That is not right. That should not be happening. That's what drives us. We cannot but stand with them and support them.
In Ireland, Colm Flynn for EWTN News in Depth.
A powerful witness. That's a wrap on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado. We hope to see you again same time next week for more news and stories important to your Catholic life. See you then.